It had been painful for Avrakatos when George had lost faith and turned on him. Claire's wife Mary had often told Avrakatos that he had saved her husband's life in Athens, and in truth Gust had loved this man, at some point probably admiring him more than any other colleague. But in Gust's eyes, all this had been overridden in the bitter spring of 1986 when Claire George let the agency be marched into the Iran-Contra swamp, putting career and the goodwill of Colonel North over agency and country alike. George had chosen to treat Gust as a saboteur. He hadn't worried about what was best for the Afghan program, and he hadn't thought about what was best for the CIA or the United States. As far as George was concerned, Gust had put him in a compromised position, and now the Aliquippen could go to Africa and rot. Gust would never again have a job at the CIA that interested him. His career was basically over. He had been done in by his old friend. It certainly didn't have to have gone that way. He could have held on to his principles and still survived if he had been willing to take a lesson from Bert Dunn. Dunn was the good guy in Avrakatos' book, the officer who had joined with him in making Afghanistan possible. He was also a pro who had backed Gust's efforts to halt the Iran disaster. But when it became perfectly clear to the veteran officer that the tide was running against him, Dunn always managed to be out of town. There was a standing joke at the task force that everyone needed to be on guard whenever Bert was off on a hunting or fishing trip. Those were the days when compromising decisions would be made, and Dunn knew enough not to be there to have to fall on his sword or go on record in support of something absolutely mad. To men like Dunn, that was the way a professional had to act. Some would even say that by his refusal to accept the larger realities, Avrakatos was demonstrating that he just didn't have the makings of a truly first-class officer. If he couldn't smile and get out of the way in his own bureaucracy, how could he be trusted to con the enemy? As Gust slipped into the obscurity of the Africa Division, sealed off from Charlie and from the growing success of the Afghan program, he had little to carry with him by way of recognition for a job well done. Normally, in such situations, a party would be given to help cushion the blow of what was, after all, a dismissal under a cloud of sorts. Normally, these affairs don't mean much, but the one Bert Dunn organized for Gust was just right. There were no official speeches, no gold watches, and certainly no agency medals like the many Howard Hart had left with. But close to 500 CIA men and women came to say goodbye. The war room and the rest of Gust's domain had been sanitized for the occasion. Bert had unleashed the logsmen to smuggle whiskey, gin, beer, and wine into the supposedly dry agency offices. At the entrance, the big Russian soldier in his frightening suit now held a Stolichnaya bottle in one hand and a Budweiser in the other. Red, white, and blue bunting was hung everywhere, framing the huge posters of the Mujahideen and the large green banners with Allahu Akbar written in both Arabic and English. There was much good cheer, even for Gust's people, who knew how complicated the moment was for their boss. The Dirty Dozen had commissioned a tribute of their own, a framed photograph showing a group of heroic Mujahideen firing off mortars. The photo interpreters and the people who concoct fake pictures had then superimposed a picture of a Greek Etzone, a World War II warrior leaping into the air. In the old days, Greek warriors wore dresses, body stockings, and funny shoes with tassels. And that's what this warrior, who had Gust's face superimposed onto his body, was wearing. Nothing could have delighted the departing chief of South Asia operations more. "Here was this wild Afzani jumping up in the air in joy as the mortars were going off," Gust says. "It was just great." That was it from the traditional CIA, nothing more. But one organization at the agency had decided that Gust deserved their official recognition. Esther Dean, an effusive 325-pound black woman from Cleveland, was acting that day as if she were giving the party when Bill Casey came down from the eighth floor to pay his respects. He and Bert Dunn were moving about, talking to members of the task force, when Esther and Gust began laughing about some secret memory. Esther had a special feeling about Gust. 2 years before, she had been his secretary when everything had fallen apart for her. In exasperation one day, Gust made a racist remark. "Esther, I know you're a fat nigger and can't talk well, but what's wrong with you?" She explained that she had gotten herself $34,000 in debt on credit card charges, and that she was about to lose everything unless a senior grade officer would sign off on a credit union loan. Would he? "On one condition," Gust told her. With that, he asked for her wallet, took out her 10 credit cards, and sliced them all up. He then had her agree to a new cash regime, signed the loan, and nursed Esther back to financial health. "Are you going to miss Mr. Evrakatos?" Casey asked Esther, not really expecting anything but a polite response. "Oh, Mr. Casey, I never thought I'd say this, but I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss him a whole bunch. I never thought I'd say this because he used to call me 'you black nigger' 4 or 5 times a day. But he's good. He's a good boss." With that, Big Esther Dean gave Gust Evrakatos a great hug and a kiss on the cheek. Casey had no way of knowing what to make of this strange spectacle. The director, who was preoccupied with the unraveling Iran-Contra affair and who was about to be diagnosed with a brain tumor, didn't mention the Afghan program, but Gust appreciated his stopping by. "See you around," was all Casey said as he left. That was when Linda, another big, spirited black woman, tapped Gust on the shoulder and told him that she and some of the other blacks would like him to come downstairs. They wanted to recognize him. Downstairs, the blacks of the CIA's Directorate of Operations were waiting for him in the records room. He knew most of them surprisingly well. In fact, he had become something of a legend with these people who manned the underbelly of the agency. They were part of Gust's intelligence network, part of what had made it possible for him to wander the halls for almost 7 months and face down Claire George in that first test of wills. Gust also viewed them differently from all of his colleagues. Who knows what's going on in the director's office? The secretary knows. And what do you do if there is a message too sensitive to send over the wires? You give it to the couriers. They're the GS-1s and 2s and 3s, and most of them were all staring at Gust right there in the records room. "I'd gone to bat for many of them," Gust recalls. The word among them was that if you're having trouble and being picked on, go see Gust. He had given many of them practical counsel, just as he had with Esther Dean. When they were getting a raw deal, if he knew their supervisor, he would put in a word for them. He ate lunch with them, he talked dirty to them, and mainly he gave them a fair shake. Thea was the spokesperson for the gathering. The CIA's blacks had an award they gave each year to one of their own who had distinguished him or herself. It was called the Brown Bomber Award, and it had never gone to a white guy. A good-looking black woman with a beautiful smile, Thea was radiant as she offered Gust the highest possible praise. "We want to give this award to the blackest motherfucker of us all." That is the only formal citation from the CIA that Gust Lascaris Evrakatos ever got. It sits by his desk with the picture of the mad Greek Ketsone leaping with joy into the air. There is also a picture of Charlie Wilson on a white horse. But for the professional underdog from Aliquippa, for the conqueror of the evil empire, the Brown Bomber Award has a special place of honor.